Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David Rode, a columnist for Reuters, a two-time winner of the Pulitzer Prize and a former reporter for The New York Times. He won his first Pulitzer for a series in the Christian Science Monitor that helped uncover the Srebrenica massacre in Bosnia, which formed the basis of his book Endgame, The Betrayal and Fall of Srebrenica. And he won his second Pulitzer in 2009 as part of the New York Times team covering Afghanistan and Pakistan. He's the co-author of A Rope and a Prayer, which is about his experience having been kidnapped by the Taliban in Afghanistan. And his latest book is Beyond War, Reimagining American Influence in a New Middle East. And his latest article at Reuters is A Feckless Response to Egypt's Avoidable Massacre. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Rode.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And why do you say that the massacre was avoidable? I mean, I did talk to some of the people that were involved in the original revolution on the secular liberal side, and they made the case. In fact, this fellow Jawad Nabulsi, who's blind in one eye, he was shot during the first revolution. He said he would go to the Muslim Brotherhood encampments every day and talk to people that he knew, and then he saw them later at the beach on the weekend, and he knew that the whole thing was petering out. So that's one explanation I've had, but what's your explanation?
I'm just referring to there were first stories in Reuters and the New York Times that there was an initial agreement that the Brotherhood had agreed to that involved the release of two lower-level Brotherhood officials. And then in exchange, the Brotherhood would sort of shrink the size of the protest. There were steps that had been set up when Bill Burns was there, you know, the Undersecretary of State, and EU representatives and others. And it was the army that sort of rejected that U.S. and European-backed plan to defuse tensions.
So would this be payback? I mean, we know that the police hated the Muslim Brotherhood, and they basically didn't do any work until this recent coup that they don't want to refer to as a coup. And they suddenly showed up on the street the next day, and gasoline appeared at the gas stations, etc. So how much of this is just a lust for vengeance on the part of the military and the police, who apparently hate the Muslim Brotherhood?
Well, to be fair, it's fear. I mean, what you'll hear from the police and the army and secular Egyptians is that we're being naive, that the situation in Cairo today is akin to Tehran, just after the revolution with Khomeini in the 70s, and that, you know, the Brotherhood wasn't going to hold further elections. Morsi was gradually consolidating power, and so you had to have this move. It's this fear among secular Egyptians that this was, you know, the Brotherhood is radical. They are armed, and they do want to create, you know, an Islamic state. You know, maybe that's true, but and there's no question Morsi did a terrible job governing the country and wasn't inclusive and many, many issues, but it certainly doesn't. I mean, I criticize the coup, but I just don't think this is the right response. These are millions of members of the Muslim Brotherhood. I think this crackdown just radicalizes them. You know, if they were planning an Islamic revolution and takeover, I guess I would have wanted to see more proof of it. And I just think this is increasing the polarization and won't solve the problem.
Well, it seems to me there's an element of a self-fulfilling prophecy here on the part of those in the West who always argue that the Islamists believe in one vote, one man, one time. And if they enter the political process, once they win, it becomes Sharia law and forget about democracy. So how much is that a factor here, that that they're creating their own nemesis?
I don't know. I mean, I should give you a more decisive answer. I think they are creating their own nemesis. I think they've overreacted, and now, it's this whole problem of, you know, looking at the political spectrum in the Islamic world. And, you know, is anyone who's an Islamist, and when I say Islamist, someone who's sort of religious and wants to see Islam as one of the guiding principles in their society, you know, are they the equivalent of Al-Qaeda militants? And, you know, my sense is no. And I think that, you don't have that. That's my sense, but clearly members of the secular elite in Egypt flatly disagree with that, think you can't trust anyone who's religious. It is a self-fulfilling prophecy. And then you have, Saudi Arabia, Israeli officials, and this sort of basic line that it's the army or anarchy. And I'm just not sure we can return to military rule. I think we're very, we're moving towards civil war, and it really could be this could be seen as this pivotal and really disastrous turn just this last week or two.
So given that you were kidnapped and a prisoner of the Taliban for some time, I take it that you had a real sort of close up and personal experience with radical Islam and those that practice it. And is this a part of our problem, you know, that it goes back to George W. Bush's response to 9/11, where he declared a war on terror, used the word jihadi, which is in many ways a noble term, didn't refer to al-Qaeda and bin Laden as gangsters or murderers or criminals, but in effect dignified them. And in general, the feeling that I get is that we alienate those very people in Islam who could help moderate those within Islam that take a more radical path. I mean, no Christian or Jew can tell a young Islamist not to take the radical path, surely.
That's the big issue. And again, is the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt the people that could do that? That, you know, again, they've renounced violence since the 1980s. The Ennahda Party in Tunisia, Prime Minister Erdogan in Turkey, and clearly these are hugely flawed movements. Erdogan's response to the Taksim Square protests were terrible. But I was recently last week with a Turkish official at an event, and they were just devastated by the scale of the bloodletting, devastated by the American response. And they did say that this is, you know, we're the ones who are trying to convince young men that democracy and the ballot box is the way to go, not jihad. And this, the way this is being handled in Egypt is just an enormous setback for them. A Reuters colleague of mine, Mira McDonald, has written a piece. There's already, there's a Kenyan offshoot of Somalia's, of the al-Qaeda affiliate in Somalia, al-Shabaab, and they tweeted, and as events are happening in Egypt, if ever there's a ripe moment to support al-Qaeda, it's surely now. And it's a piece that my colleague, again, had written from London, saying that it's almost that the Egyptian crackdown is giving al-Qaeda a new lease on life, and it's essentially saying, you know, that democracy, we believe in the West in democracy except for when Islamists win, and then, you know, it doesn't count. And but there's basically chatter online showing that already jihadists are using events there as a recruiting tool.
Well, it does seem extraordinary to when you look back at President Obama's famous speech in Cairo some years back, which was widely regarded as one of the most intelligent and nuanced Western understanding of Islam and the need for to embrace and nurture political Islam. And the only criticism came from the political right. And now it seems that Obama is roundly hated by the secular and liberal people, along with the military and their supporters, who honestly, the man on the street apparently believes that those that oppose the Muslim Brotherhood, they believe that Obama foisted the Muslim Brotherhood on Egypt. So obviously, to be an American is about the worst thing you can be now in terms of influencing Egypt. But when you look at the comparison that you make in your article, A Feckless Response to Egypt's Avoidable Massacre, David Rode, where you talk about if this is the largest massacre protest since 1989 assault on Tiananmen Square, I recall at the time that the official government response from George H.W. Bush was somewhat similar to what Obama's response has been to this, and that is the kind of realpolitik. American political establishment doesn't want to cut ties with the government and basically is trying to sort of, you know, take the path of least resistance.
It is. And you see this in sort of in Democrat and Republican administrations that they, stability. It's all about stability. And with Obama, I think you've seen a tendency to sort of split the difference. You saw that, you know, initially. He wasn't really backing the protesters that were trying to oust Mubarak. Then he sort of turned against Mubarak. And it's led to what you described exactly, where opponents, you know, secular opponents of the Muslim Brotherhood are convinced that Obama supports the Muslim Brotherhood, and at the same time, you know, Muslim Brotherhood members are convinced that Obama is supporting the coup. I don't think the U.S. can control, you know, events in Egypt, but I call it idealistic, but it's such a large number of people. It is one of the largest killings of protesters since Tiananmen Square. And, you know, I heard this myself when I was a prisoner with the jihadis. They look for hypocrisy. They look for examples of the U.S., you know, trying to protect American, European, or Israeli lives and not really being so focused on the death of Arabs or Muslims. And they will see this as another example of Western hypocrisy. They will use it as a recruiting tool. And, you know, it was an amazing speech in Cairo. There was very little follow-up to that. And you know, we sort of, as I said in the story separately, the Bush approach failed in terms of massive invasions, and this Obama approach, which is kind of vague, you know, minimalist sort of drone strikes and surveillance, you know, doesn't seem to be working either in the region. Again, we can't necessarily stop, you know, what's happening in Egypt, but we at least should have some kind of review of our broad principles. And if we're not going to support democracy, we should stop saying that we are. Or we should really cut aid and stand by these, cut aid to Egypt and stand by these democratic principles.
So, David Rode, when you were a prisoner of the Taliban and they were telling you how they see Americans' support for democracy hypocritical when it comes to Islam and Islamists, were you able to make the argument that after all, Bill Clinton intervened in the Balkans to protect the lives of European Muslims?
I did somewhat, and it was a real mix. Some of the guards would, I think, you know, heard that. You have to make that argument, and you have to stand by those principles. And some people, you know, in the Islamic world are going to hear that and believe it. There are other radicals that no matter what you say or what you do are going to be implacably opposed to the United States. So I'm not going to argue that if suddenly the U.S. embraces democracy, we're going to be popular in Egypt or be popular with jihadis. There's, you know, there is a threat. There are people that, you know, pretty much the only way to respond to them is to use force. But we're losing that sort of great middle, that young group of people in the region that I think, you know, want some form of accountable government. They want basic rights, you know, the right of free speech and the right to assembly. And, you know, again, there's some jihadis we're never going to win over no matter what we do, but I'm very concerned about the much larger group of young people that, you know, believe in these ideals and then see us not supporting them.
Well, you say in your article, at Reuters, a feckless response to Egypt's avoidable massacre, David Rode, that from massacres in Cairo to prison breaks across the region, the United States is more hated and less secure. It does seem in many ways that Iraq is the very nightmare scenario, the big lie, one of the many big lies that the Bush-Cheney people put forth to justify the invasion of Iraq was that Saddam Hussein was somehow playing footsie with al-Qaeda and that they had a base in Iraq. Well, now it appears that they do, and that one of the largest prison breaks were a number of senior al-Qaeda people, I think 800 in all, got out. And clearly that's a reality. The Sunni-Shia split seems to be being exacerbated and inflamed by the war in Syria. So it's quite possible that this whole region is going to get unglued and that we appear to be a spent force, having wasted so much in going into Iraq, where we essentially handed Iraq over to Iran and we're getting out of Afghanistan. So, well, let's start with that question. Do you think that we are a spent force in the region?
I think we are. There's no question. And the American public, I mean, in terms of mounting major military interventions, yes, we are a spent force. And there's no way the American public is going to support another big American ground invasion in the Middle East.
So
I don't think that's how we should respond to this. But yes, that's true.
So then the next question is, what could we do? Or how much, you know, is it in our interest to intervene? I mean, it seems like what we're doing and what we're not doing in Syria, you know, some people say it's cynical. It's like what Henry Kissinger said about the Iran-Iraq war that went on for 8 years. He said, you know, it's a pity both sides can't lose. Is that, do we have a policy there? Does that explain our fecklessness in Syria?
Well, I think Syria is very difficult. I think there was a window in the beginning when there, you know, the administration could have potentially armed the opposition, but Syria is a mess. I don't think we have a clear, and I don't think that even if we had armed the opposition in Syria, I'm not sure it would have worked. But I don't think there is a clear policy. I think that the administration is too focused on not being the Bush administration. I said this in the story, that there's a difference, you know, declaring that you oppose the killing of hundreds of protesters, you know, is not the equivalent of invading Iraq. And I've seen in other press reports that administration officials talk about how we have to be humble and we can't think that we can influence events in the region. We're so passive that I think it's created a vacuum. And who's moved into that vacuum? Saudi Arabia. They're strongly backing the crackdown in Egypt. So is the UAE. And, you know, they also, the Saudis have been active in Syria in the vacuum there. Who have they chosen to arm? Jihadists. I mean, the Saudis have been exporting, you know, a very hardline version of Islam for decades into the region, starting in Afghanistan in the 80s, and that's been a disaster. One of the things we should be reconsidering is our relationship to Saudi Arabia. This is all far-reaching things, but this belief that you are going to, you know, back the kingdom of Saudi Arabia and military rulers, and we can just turn the clock back, I don't believe that will work. I mean, we can have a decade-long brutal civil war in Egypt as we had in Algeria, with the web, the diffuse nature of these different al-Qaeda affiliates, I just think that's a disastrous strategy, and, you know, it's not going to be, we can't turn the clock back. And we just need to reassess our whole approach to the region. And no, we shouldn't be invading, but I think we can be distancing ourselves from the Saudis, showing more basic rights for people who participate in the political process and abide by democratic norms, focusing much more on economic issues in the region. It may be too late, but there are alternatives. It's not simply that you either invade with 100,000 troops or you do nothing. There are other ways you can work diplomatically and economically in the region to try to stabilize it or at least back more moderate groups and political parties.
So just in closing, David Rode, is it possible, though, that the subtext here is the shift underway for energy independence in the United States based upon exploitation of natural gas and fracking for oil? The U.S. is about to become the world's biggest supplier of natural gas, surpassing Russia. And when you talk about Saudi Arabia, which is absolutely true, they created the Taliban, they've destabilized Pakistan, and their mosques around the world have spread an extremely xenophobic and somewhat toxic version of Islam. There's no question that they've been duplicitous and we've been incredibly stupid. But at the end of the day, are we heading into an isolationist period? Are the people like Rand Paul going to be heard more and more? And at the end of the day, what are we losing by getting out of the Middle East?
I think we're definitely heading into a more isolationist period. And, you know, we are going to be more energy independent. The problem is, what do we do when there's huge instability in the Middle East and oil prices are going up for China and for Europe? The Chinese economy and the European economy remains, you know, hugely dependent on Middle Eastern oil. I think we should, if we can, and if, you know, I don't want to get into a debate on fracking, but if we can, you know, reduce the world's dependence on oil from the Middle East, that would be great. The U.S. currently gets more oil from Africa than it does from the Middle East. But what if China's economy starts tanking, India's economy, because they depend on Middle Eastern oil? Same thing with Europe. I mean, we live with a globalized economy. We saw what the debt crisis in Europe, you know, caused in the American economy. Slowdowns in China have an enormous impact here. So I just don't think we can pull back from the region and let it implode and think it's not going to impact us. And, you know, and for better or worse, we live in a deeply interconnected world now economically, and we can't ignore that.
Well, David Rode, thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with David Rode. He's a columnist for Reuters and a two-time winner of the Pulitzer Prize and a former reporter for the New York Times. He is the co-author of A Rope and a Prayer, which was about his experiences being kidnapped by the Taliban in Afghanistan. And his latest book is Beyond War, Reimagining American Influence in a New Middle East. And his latest article at Reuters is A Feckless Response to Egypt's Avoidable Massacre. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the declassified history of the CIA's super secret Area 51.